Well, thank you all for coming out this afternoon. My presentation is going to be a little bit different. I'm going to talk about a program that we have implemented. I'm at George Mason University now, but prior to coming to George Mason, I was at the University of South Carolina for 5 years, and that's where this program took place, and it's called Project Condom. And I'd like to acknowledge my two other authors. In particular, I'd like to acknowledge Ryan Wilson, because he is the creative genius behind Project Condom, as well as Dr. Lucy Anang, who is on the faculty in the Department of Health Promotion, Education, and Behavior at USC. I have no relationships to disclose. All right, first of all, a little overview of what I'll talk about this afternoon. I'm going to very briefly go over the history and the background of how this project came about. Very briefly, the model and the framework that we use to develop it, and then go through Project Condom and show you a lot of photos of the models that we have as a result of it, and as well as some of the lessons that we learned and some recommendations that hopefully I can share with you all should you decide you'd like to replicate this program on your campus. We've had other universities as well as high schools and community-based organizations that have replicated this program. Initially, this started back in 2007 at USC. We had the information from the American College Health Association, their Healthy Campus 2010 objectives, as well as their standards of practice for health promotion in higher education, which was promoting evidence-based practice. In particular, we wanted to make sure that we collected our own data for our own campus, which we did, and we wanted to be able to base our programming on the data that we had from our campus. So what happened was in the fall of 2007, we formed Healthy Carolina, and in particular, Healthy Carolina Task Force, which had 8 subcommittees. One of those subcommittees was the Sexual Health Subcommittee, which I was the co-chair of. And the other 7 subcommittees included physical activity, nutrition, employee health, mental health, healthy relationships, et cetera. And so each of the subcommittees was responsible for looking at the data that we collected from basically the American College Health Association's National College Health Assessment. We used the previous version at the time was available. And we looked at the data that we had collected from our own campus to select our goals and objectives. And at the time, we had our data from the spring 2006 cohort. And we had a lot of data to go through. In particular, the thing that jumped out at us was about 3/4 of our students said that they had had at least one sex partner in the last year, and over 1/4 said they had 2 or more sex partners. But of those students, only 1/2 of them said they used a condom the last time they had vaginal intercourse, and 1/4 of them said they used a condom the last time they had anal intercourse. We also found that there were high rates of STDs, et cetera, on our campus. And so our subcommittee set goals and objectives in addition to increasing screening for chlamydia. By the way, South Carolina, well, there's several things I should tell you about University of South Carolina. First of all, are you all familiar with what our mascot is? The game Cox, Go Cox, which is appropriate for a sexual health program and a lot of fun to come up with. But in addition to that, University of South Carolina sits in Columbia, and the state of South Carolina ranks consistently in the top 3 for rates of chlamydia and gonorrhea. Go Cox. And we also are in the top 10 city of Columbia for metropolitan cities with the highest rates of HIV and AIDS. So in addition to increasing condom use to prevent HIV, STI, and unintended pregnancy, we also wanted to make sure our students were screened for chlamydia and tested for HIV. So we based our programming on the socio-ecological model. Obviously, we did programming on the individual level as well as the interpersonal level. We do individual level interventions as well as a lot of group level interventions, but we also wanted to make sure that we address the environmental concerns on our campus. And so I would include this program as a structural level intervention, which the goal is to change the context on campus to promote, in this case, condom use. And we wanted to make sure that condoms were everywhere. They were available, accessible, affordable, and hopefully acceptable to students. So Project Condom was one of several initiatives that we were promoting on campus. In addition, we have always had condoms available for free, but we wanted to make sure they were known, that they were available for free, and we wanted to increase their availability, which we have, by the way, since this program went into effect. The number of condoms made available has grown exponentially. We also tried, and this is a whole nother presentation, on trying to get condom vending machines in residence halls. That attempt failed. Not by the students, but by administration. And we also did a condom cover design contest. And that's a picture, by the way, of Ryan. He is, again, as I said, the mastermind for this Project Condom. So what was Project Condom? The concept is based on the show Project Runway. The idea was, let's do a fashion show where all of the fashions are designed out of condoms. And we want to make sure that we include a lot of education. And it was inspired by the work of Adriana Bertini, who does a lot of designs based out of condoms, excuse me, to raise money and awareness about HIV and AIDS. So planning the event, obviously we needed to gain administrative approval. That took a number of weeks in and of itself. But once we gained approval, we obtained a sponsor, which was One Condoms, and they have been fabulous as far as providing us with the condoms. They send us thousands of unlubricated, unpackaged, multicolored condoms that we give out to different groups where they can make their garments. But prior to that, we created a planning committee. We set the schedule. Project Condom takes place the week before spring break. Things happen during spring break. And by the way, then we do chlamydia and HIV testing a couple weeks after spring break. And then we reserve the Student Union Ballroom, which holds up to 600 students, and that's with the full runway setup. We reserved a DJ, spotlights, we have a projector and a screen. We had to identify co-hosts, which were our peer educators, of course. We had Project Runway music. And we had to write a script that had to be both educational and entertaining, and it mirrored, was based upon the Project Runway television show. So we're coming up on year four of Project Condom, and we have a number of sponsors as this has grown. And one thing that I think is important to realize is we want to make sure that it's educationally focused. Each year, there's a different theme for Project Condom. The first year, the theme was everyone has a choice. Communication, contraception, abstinence, condoms, make it work. We wanted to make sure that everyone has a choice. And one of the things that the administration said that they would only approve this is if we include abstinence. And so I'm glad that Dr. McDermott brought up abstinence, because we do include abstinence as one of the messages. And also the second season was Tell Them. Tell Them is one of the organizations that sponsored the program. So we had incorporated in the messaging and the themes is Tell Them Why Condoms Are So Important. And then the third year is Now Education Is in Style. So we had to promote the event, and we did that in a number of ways. Obviously, we did a lot of advertising, and we had invitations sent to over 340 student organizations and distributed the old-fashioned way, the handbills on campus, as well as on Green Street on campus out in front of the Student Union. We had a table set up with displays. But of course, in the new generation, you got to make sure you incorporate technology. So we had a Facebook page where we sent out over 1650 student invitations, letting them know that Project Condom was coming, as well as a MySpace page. And then we had ground rules. And student organizations, it could be classes, it could be residence halls, any group, could apply to enter to Project Condom. Each group was provided with 1,000 condoms of assorted colors and white. They're allowed to use a fabric as a base. They had to. They could use hot glue, liquid latex, or they could sew the condoms onto the fabric. PG-13 was required. You had to have modesty. You couldn't just. We told guys you can't just walk out wearing a condom. That's good, but we need a little more coverage. And in addition, the other thing was the students had to come up with their own theme for their own garment. what does your garment represent? And it could, again, be specific to abstinence, pregnancy prevention, HIV, STI, et cetera. Prior to the doors opening, they had a dress rehearsal. They had everything set up, and they made sure that all of the entrants had an opportunity to walk down the runway and get practice doing that. There were giveaways. All students that came received the tins with the condoms in them, and as the years have gone by, we've given out more and more elaborate gifts, t-shirts, bags, water bottles, all kinds of fun giveaways. There are our hosts, the two peer educators, and they had their own little scripts. There's Ryan again. We also had judges, and the judging was not just based on the garments and how great they looked, but also it had to be based, on, again, on the theme, as well as making sure that they had a good educational message. And we've had different guest judges, mostly from campus, but this past year we had Santino Rice from the show Project Runway actually come and be a guest judge. So this was the season one, and you'll notice as we go through the seasons, the outfits get a lot better. This was an abstinence outfit, and the young woman had all white condoms, but they were underneath lace. And her message was that I'm waiting till I'm ready, and then when I'm ready, I will use condoms. Pretty amazing. A little flapper outfit, yeah. She had spring break on her bottom. In condoms. This was the winning dress. I think it was just because this girl could work it. She had legs for days. And each of the designers were asked questions specific about their garment, but mostly, again, it's about the messaging. And then, of course, the Daily Gamecock has their messages about Project Condom and the messages that they sent. The first year, the winning dress was on display at the American College Health Association annual meeting in Orlando and at the International AIDS Conference in Mexico City. The One Condoms Global Protection Corps took it on display. Season two, by the way, the first year we had 10 entrants. The second year we had, I believe, 14. Then we finally got more guys involved. I was really proud. This is Condom Man, one of the fraternities. She was carrying a dog. I swore it was a real dog. It was made out of condoms. Her purse is made out of, everything's made out of condoms. Pretty amazing. And this was the weight, the abstinence message. Raincoat made all out of condoms. Yeah, pretty amazing. And I was presenting this at the HIV conference, and we had someone from the British Medical Journal come. This woman's dress was they made to promote the Gardasil vaccine. The second year, we made sure to incorporate more education. They did the 10 steps for how to put on a condom. They did a condom demonstration. And the peer educators did commercial breaks. They created their own commercials on abstinence and how to use condoms and also making sure you get consent before you have sex. We also made sure we didn't have a lot of evaluation prior. This has been a challenge. We put a little short survey in the chairs and had the students fill it out, just asking them about increasing their knowledge, et cetera. And then this past season, just amazing to me, the dresses that they came up with. This was the winning dress. This is the one that Santino was there to judge. And by the way, if you all want a copy of this, I can send you. We also have, these are all on YouTube. You can go watch them. And each season, we promote the next season on YouTube. We also did a survey. One thing I recommend if you want to do this, we put the survey online, or I should say Carolina Productions did it for us, and they promoted it the week after, which was spring break, so we had terrible response, but very good numbers. Anyway, my advice to you all is if you want to replicate this, contact me and or Ryan, and we'll give you all the information, but the advice is to establish a working group. If you have access to your own data, you can obviously design it the way that you need to. Make sure you involve students and use an ecological approach. Now that I'm at George Mason, we're going to try it there. And we actually have Mondo coming, and he's living with HIV, so we're doing this during HIV Awareness Week. So that's my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. So now we'll open it up for questions and discussions for all of our presenters, and we've got about 25 minutes for those. So.
I was very interested in your presentation. That it seemed that condoms were 100% everything from your talk. How did you incorporate the reality of condoms not being successful, especially in anal sex and the STDs?
Can you repeat the question?
Let me make sure I understand. Not being successful... as far as not being 100% effective, is that what you mean? Well, we absolutely talk about that, but the main messages that we send is what the CDC talks about, is that condoms are highly effective, especially when we talk about HIV, but they have to be used correctly and consistently. And so we talk about the importance of understanding how to use them correctly, so that's why we teach the steps for how to use them correctly, and making sure that you use them all the time. If you don't use them, then that's not going to help. But we also talk about the fact that they don't protect against all different STDs. They're highly effective with different STDs, but we don't address necessarily specifically about anal intercourse. I'm not sure what you're referring to. Well, we've not talked about that, no. Did you have a question?
Yeah.
I would like to see that because I've not seen that. No. Properly, right. Absolutely. Yeah, and we do talk about making sure you use water-based lubricants and all of that, which would absolutely make sure that you're using condoms. That's part of making sure you use condoms appropriately. Yeah. Go ahead.
Large public universities.
Okay. And my other question is, there was increase in sexually active students from the time they enrolled to like semester afterwards in spring. Do you know any reasons that could be? Could that be related to stress or could that be related to other factors?
If you can't hear the question, the question she asked was, you know, I cited a study that showed that the percentage of college students enrolling the first semester, their freshman year, that had not had sexual intercourse previously was 49%, and by spring of the same year it was 28%. And the question is, I think, why do I think that has happened?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I think that for a lot of college youth, it's their first time away from home. They're unsupervised. They have lots of opportunities for sexual participation. And it's just, in developmental terms, it's a time for exploring relationships and new things. And it's I think it's that probably will account for an awful lot of that variance.
Yeah, well, it's hard to say, and I would love any advice that you all can give us, because we've struggled with that. That's one of the things about structural interventions is we can document how many condoms have been taken, and I can tell you in the last 2 years, the number of condoms have, as far as being used on campus, have gone up exponentially. It was 14,000 to 22,000, and they've already exceeded that this year. But can we say it's from this program specifically? No. But they're using it. Well, they're taking them. I don't know. Maybe they're making balloons out of them, but yeah. Yeah. Or dresses out of them. That's what, hopefully not.
And what sites did you use to distribute condoms?
Well, mostly, for instance, I was a faculty member, so different faculty members would take them and distribute them. Mostly residence hall advisors would take them and distribute them. We wanted to be able to put them in the residence halls, either in the restrooms or near the restrooms, and we got approval from the residence hall association. Students approved that, but the administration was concerned of what parents would think about that. No.
And number two, do you think the reasons, or do you know the reasons why they were adding the controls to the medications? Is that more because of parental pressures or race board or?
I wasn't privy to those conversations, so I don't know specifically what the reasons were given. It just kind of was allowed to die. We had very great enthusiasm among the peers. I think in a way we didn't fight it because we were still able to give them away for free. The thought was that if students were paying at least even a nominal fee, I mean, it was only going to be like 50 cents or something for a condom, but that's a little more ownership and a little more privacy in being able to pick them up, to purchase them. But the struggle, just because it was in the newspaper, the debate was in the newspaper, students were arguing for and against, and it was a good debate to have on campus, and ultimately, the students wanted it. You know, I could give you my spiel on why I think, but I can't tell you exactly why, so I don't want to do that. I'm sorry. Ma'am in the back. Yes, Dr. Kirby? Yes. Right. Yes, definitely. Absolutely. Well, one of the things, and I think you all noticed that, is that as far as condom use goes, I think even in your research, is that females obviously are less likely to use them. Females. We were reaching mostly females in our program, and in a way that was good, but you're absolutely right. We need to make sure. And the other thing that we don't know is, are we preaching to the choir? Are these the students that are already using the condoms, that are already pro, you know, let's they're comfortable with it, and let's use it and promote the message. That's the other question that I don't know the answer to, that I would like to find the answer to. Yes, ma'am.
May I have a question for Dr.
Yeah, please.
I was taking from your presentation, thank you very much, that those universities have done a very good job of doing their sexual education because these women seem to be afraid of the STDs and that type of thing. Is that a correct thing that I took away from your presentation?
Well, I don't think we could go that so far as to say that. Clearly, there had been uptake of condom, pro-condom messages by the people who were responding to this survey, but I'm not sure that we could say that that was necessarily because of specific work that the university or universities had done to promote those messages. The at one of the universities, the respondents were responding who were enrolled in a personal health course, and at the other university in a sexual health course. So it could be that they were more sensitized to some of those issues, although we did the surveys at the beginning of the term, so there would not have been a lot of exposure to messages in that class, if any, actually. But it's, but I don't think you can necessarily attribute it to the universities. We'd like to think so. We'll take credit for it, but I'm not sure that you can.
I just had a question for the second presenter, David, is it?
Yeah, David.
David, I really enjoyed your talk. I thought it was really nicely, cleanly presented.
Thank you.
Data, fantastic. I was interested in your very last slide, though, when you were kind of beginning to speculate about mm-hmm. some of the stuff, and it occurred to me you probably need an entirely different methodology, I guess, to explore some of the things that underlie the differential use of emergency contraceptive or oral contraceptive, for example, and as you said, sort of contingent morality, qualitative methodology,
oh,
I guess.
Yes.
I just wondered if you had any plans to do that, because I think it would be very exciting to explore what was going on there.
I think this question I'll yield to my PI of the study, since I work for him.
He works with me. We work together. So it's a good question, and I think so. The end was a real challenge, I think, for us. We sat down and sort of explored those data. The fact that Hispanic women were less likely to use oral contraceptives, reported greater rates of unintentional pregnancy, but they also reported greater rates of EC use, and it wasn't a small difference. We didn't sit around and make up reasons for why that was. We actually went back to the literature to look at some qualitative research, some other research to see sort of what that meant, because that was certainly a finding we did not expect to see. As it stands, I don't have plans to investigate that. So I think if there's interested master's or doctoral students, that kind of research would make great thesis or dissertation topics. Free idea, take it and run with it. But I'm interested in discussing more about that. The conditional morality one was a sort of a piece that we felt very hesitant to mention. It sounds kind of like you bring up morality issues, but it's more of an issue of maybe that use of oral contraceptives on a daily basis represents something that Hispanic women may not want to choose because of their religious beliefs. However, when faced with a difficult decision like a pregnancy that might have greater implications, maybe a one-time use of a hormonal contraceptive like EC might be sort of less difficult of a decision to make. So, I'm interested to hear other comments that you all might have also. I also have go ahead.
I had a question, not about that, but for Dr. McDermott. I had a question about the list of 12 methods that you used in your survey, and you mentioned that those were indicated as the top 12 most frequently used methods by students?
No, they were we simply asked students to identify contraceptive methods with which they were familiar, and those were the 12 that appeared most frequently.
Okay. And was that a free response, or did you give them a list and they chose?
No, it was a free, open-ended response.
Okay. I was just a little concerned about the mention of douching. I'm not familiar with that as a method that's encouraged by the medical community. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yes, we wouldn't encourage it either. We also don't encourage withdrawal, which also is on the list.
Right.
But, you know, this is a study in realism, and these are methods that the students are identifying, and so certainly from a content validity point of view, that's an important strategy to generate that list from. Now, of course, the educational side of that would be to discourage, you know, a number of things that shouldn't be used. I mentioned that we're now in year 25 of monitoring this, and over that period of time, contraceptive methods have come and gone. On earlier studies, we would have had the contraceptive sponge, would have had the IUD, and in fact, I think in one of the previous studies, we even sort of differentiated among different varieties of IUD. And in this study, obviously, there are some, the Nuva ring and the patch are things that have come into the, not only come into use, but come into the student vernacular, even since we did that study in 2000.
I have a question for Dr. McDermott, and also for Marlene Allison. So this continues this discussion of contraceptive methods. The national campaign to run Teen Unplanned Pregnancy certainly has an increased initiative to promote long-acting reversible contraceptives, IUD, Implanon, and Depo, the shot. You mentioned, Marlene, the IUD, specifically in school-based health centers. And I'm interested just to hear more about your thoughts on those methods. Dr. McDermott, maybe perhaps if you want to talk a little bit about whether you intend to add those methods to future surveys. And Marlene, just a little bit more about the work that you've done in school-based health centers around those methods, because they are highly efficacious, don't involve daily interaction by users, which is why they're being promoted by the national campaign.
Well, the quick answer is that in our generation of those specific methods, at least two of those that you mentioned appeared by, was generated by some of the respondents, but clearly not in the numbers to make us think that that we were going to get a lot of user experience data or maybe even widespread familiarity with it. So in an effort to make the survey less burdensome, we limited the number. But in the future, I think if we use that same method to generate a list of contraceptive options that students are familiar with, and those appeared on it, then certainly.
And for us, we educate the students, as I said, on the whole gamut of the different types of contraceptives. And so that the student can make an educated choice. Now, even though we try to steer them towards IUDs, we're finding that the students in our population are not being so accepting of the IUDs.
See, that part I think would be extremely interesting to assess the attitudes of those methods to then hopefully develop sort of promotional campaigns, or at least campaigns that might dispel myths or misconceptions, or to change those attitudes, because they're cost effective, especially the IUD in 5-year rates, much more so than oral contraceptive pills. But what are those attitudes? And I think we don't really know enough about those attitudes to do any sort of programming around.